This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself to see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes and could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states. Chime is changing the way people bank. Unlike traditional old banks that still charge overdraft and monthly fees, Chime offers rewarding fee-free banking that's built for you, not the 1%. And that includes thousands of fee-free ATMs, because who wants to pay to access their own money? Chime users' savings grow faster with a 3.75% APY. That's 9 times higher than the national average. You can stack your benefits with perks like cashback and even airport lounge access included with your Chime card. If you're serious about managing your money but want to keep it simple, then Chime is a no-brainer. My younger self would really have benefited from something like this. Chime is not just smarter banking. It is the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded. It only takes a few minutes to sign up.
Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services for MyPay and Chime Card provided by Chime's bank partners. Optional products and services may have fees or charges. Stated annual percentage yield and cash back for Chime Prime only. No minimum balance required. Checking account ranking based on a J.D. Power survey published October 20, 2025. For more information on APY rates, MyPay, SpotMe, and travel perks, go to chime.com/disclosures.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And welcome to Red Handed. I have nothing to say.
The end.
The end.
Thanks so much for coming.
The red hot in it.
No. We basically got down into the studio today and then just immediately were like, nothing's working.
Mm-hmm.
I can't hear your voice through my headphones. Why is this not lighting up? Why are all the cables in a big snake nest of wires? It's been a tricky morning, but we are now running 45 minutes behind schedule. And everything's gone to pot. But it's okay because we have got the Queen's birthday this weekend.
And no, we don't.
No, it's next weekend, isn't it? Well, I mean, we get to celebrate this weekend.
I think she likes having two.
She does like having two. Well, whatever. We get 4 days off this weekend. So there we go.
And we'll have to pay for that next week. Anyway, never mind. We've got a tricky case for you. It's just been a tricky week. This is absolutely a big hitter. You probably have heard it on other podcasts, maybe you've watched a documentary or two. But the thing about this case is that it is so enormous. Telling the story in a succinct and listenable way is quite difficult, but we've done our absolute best. So let's take ourselves off to the USSR. In the mid-1980s, in the smallish mining town of Shakhty in then Soviet Russia, a woman working in a factory looked over her colleague's shoulder. He always carried a notebook with him and could often be seen scribbling away in it. She'd always wondered what he was doing in that little book. So one day, she took the chance and had a look.
It's like you imagine he's going to be, you know, drawing romantic pictures of you or writing love poems.
Yeah, or, you know, copying out all of the communist leaders. He loved doing that too, but that's not what he was doing. When she did finally see the internal pages of her colleague's notebook, she saw that he hadn't been writing notes or love letters or pictures of dogs. He hadn't even been writing words. All he had doodled was rows and rows of little crosses. And those images puzzled her for years. She wouldn't understand what those little crosses meant until 1993.
Our story this week doesn't start in the mid-80s, however. It starts under the reign of Stalin, in Soviet Russia, where your dog walks you. The man who drew the crosses over and over again in that notebook started his life, as you might expect, as a little boy. A boy called Andrei Romanovich Chikatilo.
So, I've learned lots of Russian this week. Chikatilo is a Ukrainian name. Romanovich just means son of Roman, his father. So, you've probably heard him referred to as Andrei Chikatilo. And Chikatilo doesn't mean anything.
No.
He even says in interviews later, he's like, it's just a collection of letters. It literally doesn't mean anything, which makes me sad. I don't like it when names don't mean things.
But it also is quite fitting for him, I think.
Yes, he is an empty vessel.
Just this empty, meaningless vessel.
Yep.
Spoilers.
Start as we mean to go on.
Yes, precisely. So Chikatilo was born in 1936 in Yablochnoye, near the Ukrainian border. It was once the breadbasket of the region, but by the time our cross doodler was brought into the world, it was, much like his name, totally empty and pretty barren.
So let's kick off with an extremely quick history of the region for those of you who did not do GCSE history. 1917 saw the first Russian Revolution. That's the one that got the Tsars out and Lenin in. But that revolution was very much an urban one. Life in places like Yablochnoye really didn't change that much. The following civil war didn't really touch them either. The Bolshevik Party promised to electrify every home, but that promise didn't bother the farmers either. The news probably didn't reach that many people in rural areas anyway.
Very convenient to promise to electrify all homes when the people who don't have electricity in their homes can't hear you say that.
Yeah, I think the most important thing to remember is that Russia's fucking huge. And it was even huger when it was the USSR.
Much to Putin's chagrin.
Chagrin. Yeah, so it's actually very important for this story to remember that not only is it massive, communication is slight at best and everything is censored. Remember those things. You'll need them later on.
But the countryside, disconnected from the rest of Russia or not, would be thrust into politics in the 1920s, whether they liked it or not, because the 20s brought with it the grain crisis. The kulaks and the middle peasants were not handing over the grain that they should have been, and Stalin was not happy about it.
Yeah, a kulak is like
someone who owns anything.
If you own more than 8 acres, you're a kulak.
Because I was watching an interview with, he's a comedian, his family are Russian, he was born in Russia, and he was saying basically that his family were considered kulaks, but he was like, all they had was a horse. All they had was a horse, and they were like, you're a kulak, get in the fucking gulag.
I mean, yes, that does happen, but technically speaking, my understanding is that a kulak is someone who has more than 8 acres. Anything less than that, you're a middle peasant, so you're still owning something, because Stalin doesn't want anyone to own anything at all.
No. You got a horse, you're the bourgeoisie, get in the bin.
Yeah, get in Siberia. Yeah, exactly.
So yes, these people weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing under Stalin, and he was pretty pissed. So on the 27th of December 1929, in celebration of the Man of Steel's 50th birthday, Big Joe announced the collectivization of all farms, which we know from history always works out really well. Nothing ever goes wrong, and millions of people definitely don't die of starvation. Basically, in case you don't know what we mean when we say collectivization of all farms, it basically means that no one was allowed to not play ball anymore. No one was going to be allowed to not hand over their grain because they don't own that land anymore. The people, the country, the state, Stalin, he owns the land. You work the land. We take the grain. You can keep a bit of it, but you're going to starve.
No, you can't keep any of it.
Oh, you can't keep any of it.
It all goes to the state and then the state decides what you get.
Sure.
So previously, before his like collectivization announcement, the deal was that they could keep a bit.
But then they were keeping too much.
They were keeping too much.
And by too much, we mean, yeah.
Yeah, enough to survive. Yeah.
They were just hoarding all this grain.
He just didn't really particularly hated private property, did Big Joe?
Yes, I mean, as communists tend to do. So Big Joe went a step further because he also announced the obliteration of the kulak class.
Yeah, it wasn't a secret.
No, so he's basically like anyone who is an owner of private property, an owner of any kind of assets, we're going to completely obliterate that group of people. So the revolution was finally making itself known in the countryside, and the kulaks were sent to Ukraine, the Urals, Siberia, and Kazakhstan, which in many cases was, as you can imagine, just a death sentence. Many people died on their way there, and those who survived the journey found their destinations to be utterly uninhabitable. It's a genocide, isn't it? It's nothing else.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Farmers naturally didn't love this idea, so they started to kill their cattle in protest, which meant there was even less food to go around than before. And apparently there's a Russian saying that in 1929, peasants only ate meat because they were just like, if I can't have it, no one fucking can. But obviously that meant there was not any food. And then Stalin enforced his own famine in 1932, and that killed 10 million people. The Ukraine region was hit particularly hard, but Stalin didn't care because Ukraine had always been quite separatist, and he was like, they're a problem, so if they all die, my life is easier. And famously, Stalin's opinion was, one man's death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. And that's like pretty Leninist of him also, because Lenin always used to say, the worse it is, the better it is for you, because like the worse people's lives are, the more they're going to back a revolution. So I feel like Lenin is often painted as the like quite nice older grandfather, and then Stalin is the one that comes and fucks you up. But like, it was all...
They're all bad.
Yeah.
It's all bad.
I think Stalin...
killed 10 million people.
At least. And also...
and the fucking rest.
Yeah. He is at the same time one of the most successful leaders of all time and the worst. I was listening to a podcast about it last night, actually. Every time my sister comes home, she's like, what are you listening to? And I'm like, something about Stalin. He started his reign in Russia with a wooden plow, and he ended it in the space race, all in 30 years. And that is, if you don't care about millions of people dying, very impressive.
I mean, yes. The main part being, if you don't care about millions of people dying, and also terrible, terrible policies like collectivization and the destruction of any kind of private property or private ownership. But did you know that, and this number varies from place to place, but there was a poll done in Russia very recently in 2021. What year is it now? 2022. 2021? What year?
2022.
So last year, it found that 56% of Russians support Stalin. I mean, I know he's not around to be supported, but I'm trying to think of what the right word is. Approve of Stalin. Mm-hmm. Like, remember him fondly, whatever the word is.
I mean, it depends on your ideology, right? Like, because you can look at it both ways, depending on where you're from and what you value. Like, some people would argue that the change that he did make in Russia was impossible without all of these people dying. Same with like Mao Zedong, whatever. That's not how I would think about it. But
you can say that those changes weren't going to be possible without millions of people dying, but it's like, but they were a bad idea and they killed millions of people.
Yeah, but if he achieved his goals, you know, so if you agree with the goals, then you could argue that the ends justify the means. I don't, but some people do.
Yeah, but that's, but I think they are worthy of criticism, because that's like being like, oh, well, if you like Hitler's policies, he achieved his goals. He got really close.
No, that's exactly what
I'm
saying.
Yeah, like, I know.
If your ideology matches up with the Third Reich, then the Third Reich makes sense, you know?
Of course. But it's shocking to me that still today, well, maybe it shouldn't be shocking anymore, but still today that over half of Russians are like, yeah, pretty top bloke, Stalin.
Summer is in full swing, and what better time to refresh your underwear drawer? You know we love and trust in Honeylove to keep us comfortable and supported even on the sweatiest sun-soaked days. Honeylove are an independent female-founded brand who just get what we're looking for, with products intelligently designed by women who actually wear them. I am absolutely obsessed with their Cloud Embrace bra. It's a wireless bra that still holds the girls up, so I don't feel like I'm sacrificing support for comfort. And if you've still got some weddings this season, Honeylove are coming in clutch with the shapewear you need to cut up the dance floor. Treat yourself to the most advanced bras and shapewear on the market. Use our exclusive link to save 20% off Honeylove at honeylove.com/redhanded. That's honeylove.com/redhanded. After you check out, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience the new standard in comfort and support with Honeylove. Have you been sitting on an amazing business idea, but you're just not sure how to get started? Shopify can help you with everything you need to make it happen. Shopify powers millions of businesses worldwide, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to small businesses just getting started. The multifunctional platform includes tools like Shopify Checkout, which helps convert your customers' baskets into real sales. With cool features like saving checkout details for easy repeat sales, Shopify makes it a total breeze. When we first started selling merch for Red Handed, it was such a relief to actually see people buying it and coming back for more. And because Shopify handles the setup and checkout process, it gives you more time to focus on actually growing your business. With Shopify, nothing stands between your idea and a real business. So go make it one. Start your free trial at shopify.com/redhanded. That's shopify.com/redhanded.
Once the kulaks were out, the old ways were abolished in the rural areas as well as the city, and private property was replaced with total collectivism, mainly because everyone was dead.
Yeah, they killed everyone who owned anything, and then they were like, well, now there's no one to own anything.
Yeah,
so we'll own it.
The miracle of communism.
I actually think this might have been one of the worst times in history, geographically, politically, time-wise, everything. It was like a perfect storm of fucking nightmares. Yep.
100%. Can't argue.
You had Stalin, you had the Nazis. Famines were so severe that children had to eat grass in order to survive. And of course, rumours of cannibalism ran rife through the farmlands.
And I think I put rumours in there just sort of like cover us, but in 1933, people were 100% eating people in Russia. 100%.
They were. Of course they
Fact.
Were. But rumours, not because some, like, you know, fucking middle peasant from the pasto times is going to come back and sue us. Because, like we say all the time on the show, cannibalism is hard to prove. But if you weren't dead, then you were probably eating people.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't anything else to eat. A little human steak with a side of grass.
And your dead horse.
Yeah, and your dead horse. And of course, you know, this is because hungry people do desperate things. And so, little Andrei Chikatilo, don't forget about him, knew this too, almost too well. All of his life, Andrei was told that his brother, and in some sources it says his cousin, had been kidnapped and eaten 2 years before Andrei was born.
The other thing about this story is everyone has about 17 different names, so it's very difficult to keep track. We've read two books, both translated from Russian, poorly, so it has been a bit of a struggle. There are many versions of this story. Andrei Chikatilo himself says that it was his brother. I've read in other books that it was his cousin. Anyway, this kid is called Stefan, and Stefan, he never knows him. He dies, well, he disappears 2 years before he's born. But the most important thing to remember is that he grows up with this story of someone who is related to him being kidnapped, killed, and eaten.
Yeah. I mean, parents tell their kids, like, the boogeyman will come get you if you don't eat your dinner. And this bear, like, your cousin / brother, Stefan, actually got kidnapped by some people and got eaten. The end.
Which was happening.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And it's not even to get you to eat. It's to get you to eat your grass, Andre. Like, obviously, that is an incredibly traumatizing thing to tell a child. But they were growing up in an incredibly fucked up and traumatizing time. So, yeah, there was probably not much else to talk about. So, because of the fear of what happened, or what he at least believed to have happened, Andrei never strayed far from home, terrified that he too would be snatched. And this is, of course, also a major plot line in Red Dragon Rising.
Of course. I didn't even think of that.
I will always think of that. I will always think of the tacky-ass horror movie that I can drag into this. So allegedly, Andrei had a totally normal relationship with his mother. And I know he hasn't exactly said this, but it's not like it's a direct quote. But I do think if anybody tells you, I have a totally normal relationship with my mother. Red flag.
Yeah.
So although we're not sure how normal any relationship that contains a child cannibalism story, because it's presumably probably his mum that told him this horrendous story about Stefan, can really be, that is also what the books say.
It's an interesting angle to take, because obviously, it's not a secret, Andrei Chikatilo goes on to do horrendous things, or we wouldn't be here talking about him. It's not like, and he lived happily ever after and got a cat. Like, it's not the situation. But there is really not that much about his relationship with his mother in any of the sources we can find. But I don't believe for a second it was normal. We do know a little bit more about Andrei's father. He was enlisted in the Red Army when the Nazi forces were occupying what's now Ukraine. And he was captured during battle, and he spent years either in a concentration camp or a POW camp, depending on which book you read. Either way, when he returned home after the war, he was treated with great suspicion by the Stalinist state.
They loved to do that, didn't they? It was like, if you were a POW or you spent time like being captured and behind enemy lines and you've gone to a concentration camp, they weren't like, welcome you home like a war hero and like, oh my God, you really, you know, took one for the team. They're like, what the fuck were you up to over there?
Yeah, 100%. Because he had essentially worked for enemies of the state during the war, even though he had no choice. That didn't really matter. He was the enemy.
Yeah, it's almost like very like Spartan in its beliefs. Like, you should have just died instead of being caught.
Yeah, you should have died rather than coming home without your shield. You know?
Yeah, yeah. With your shield or on it.
Yeah.
Andre's dad.
Because being a literal prisoner forced into labor wasn't enough for the KGB. And it's pretty ironic that had his father died in battle, Andrei Chikatilo would have been considered the son of a hero. But in reality, Chikatilo's father was treated with great suspicion and sent off to work in the mines.
So Andrei had an outcast father and a mother who told him that he was at constant risk of being eaten. What could possibly go wrong?
Recipe for a happy time.
You're fine. You're fine, kid. But shockingly, as you're about to find out, quite a lot could and did go wrong. Once Chikatilo was old enough to go to school, he immediately had a terrible time. He was shockingly short-sighted and too afraid to tell his teachers that he couldn't read the board.
That breaks my heart. Like, I know he goes on to do really horrible things, but I just, like, it just strikes such a chord with me. Just like children just like being too scared to say they don't understand. Because it was me.
No, I can get it. I think, again, it's the kind of society where you're being led by someone like Stalin, like the archetypal strong man. And then you're here, this kid of an outcast already. And then you're in class and you're being like, I also can't see. People are just going to be like, oh, you're a total fucking loser.
Yeah, fuck you, Specky Four Eyes.
Precisely. Precisely.
I don't know what that is in Russian.
So Chikatilo taught himself to read at home. And he wouldn't actually get glasses until he was 30.
I imagine there weren't that many optometrists kicking around in a Soviet bloc Ukraine.
Mm-mm. So Chikatilo, the eyes weren't the only problem. His body gave him other troubles as well. Later, he would say the following, quote, during childhood, I spent more time with female friends. Even now, I relate better to women. When I was a child, boys became more attached to me, as if I were a girl. I no longer know which sex I relate to. I like the attention of men. An adult Chikatilo would argue that he had larger breasts than his male classmates, and also that his foreskin was an odd shape, which attracted even more ridicule. But his peers remember him as being good-looking and well-built. His nickname was even Andre the Strong. But they did all agree that he was a little bit reclusive.
Yeah, I mean, Andre paints this very tragic picture of himself. But then other contemporaries were like, yeah, sure, he was a dork, but like he wasn't feeble. Mm-hmm. And he makes himself out to be this like shadow of a boy. And that's not what other people who were there say.
Mm.
They actually said that he was tough. But even if he was definitely shit with the ladies. That's something we know for sure. After school, he went on to do his military service. But uncharacteristically for a young soldier, one might argue, he had absolutely no interest in sex, and he gained a reputation amongst the other soldiers for being gay. But he did manage, during his national service, to go on a date with one girl, and he even managed to get a cuddle in. But the girl was not so keen. After a few moments in his embrace, she pulled away. But remember, he was Andre the Strong, and he refused to let her go. He enjoyed that moment of struggle, and although he didn't know it yet, the pursuit of that feeling would shape the rest of his life, and eventually his death. In 1954, he had completed his service and was introduced to a girl called Tanya Barla.
Oh, hello. Hey, sis. That's so strange.
I know.
I feel like wherever we are in the world, it like randomly pops up the name Barla. I swear we did see it on places when we were in Indonesia, and now here in Ukraine, of all places.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lake in Wales called Lake Barla.
Oh, there you go.
Don't know why. Can someone tell me why? Why is there a lake in Wales called Lake Barla?
So he gets introduced to Sruti's friend, Tanya Barla. And to everyone's surprise, they got on. Tanya was like, you know what? He's a bit shy, but he's reasonably good looking.
And he's so strong.
And he's so strong. If you look at pictures of him before all of his teeth fall out, it's not terrible. You know, it's not terrible.
Andre Chikatilo young?
Mm. He's not young Stalin hot, but you know.
No, he's all right. He all right.
On the topic of young Stalin, I've got a better one. Young Benjamin Netanyahu, fucking smoke show, slamming hottie. Don't believe me, look it up.
It's true. I can vouch for it. So Tanya Barla, seemed to like Chikatilo, and the pair were soon rolling around in fields together. But they never made it to the main event, because all it took was for Chikatilo to climb on top of Tanya, fully clothed, and he would come all in his pants.
Oh, so no.
Mm-hmm. He was so mortified by this that he swore never ever to touch another vagina except for his future wives.
It's always the vagina's fault, isn't it? Always blame the vagine. Like, it's nothing to do with you, Andre.
Oh, dear.
Those pesky vaginas.
He was also no longer going to pursue women. And he decided that he was going to throw himself into his studies instead. Studying in Soviet Russia was exactly what you think it was. There were a select few elite colleges, and then loads and loads and loads of technical ones. Chikatilo had done an excellent job of teaching himself every school subject, and had his sights set firmly on Russia's top university, Moscow State. He made the most of his reclusive hyperfixation, and passed all of the incredibly difficult exams, but found himself rejected on quote-unquote political grounds.
One of the other, I don't know if myth is the right word, but one of the stories surrounding Andre Chikatilo is that he was incredibly intelligent and therefore frustrated by his Soviet life. I don't think that's true. I think he was average at best. I think there were just not that many opportunities for people to go on to further education.
Yeah. And it's something we often see when we're talking about particularly serial killers, but generally I would say any type of violent criminal. There's always this sort of like noise in the background. If they're even reasonably intelligent, basically if they're not completely stupid, people are like, oh my God, he was a genius.
Yeah.
And I'm like, was he? He's actually got pretty average intelligence. Like, he's not a genius. He just wasn't like, you know, stumbling around, like setting himself on fire by accident and doing all sorts of crazy things. Like, he's not a genius.
No, I really don't think he was. I mean, in the books and stuff, they'll always be like, oh, and he could recite all of the communist leaders. And I'm like, duh, that's probably all it was in school.
Yeah, that's
like,
all he had to teach himself to read. No, I think it's just this idea. Again, we talk about it in the book a little bit, but this sort of like fetishization, you know, that's not a hot take. This sort of fetishization of serial killers that we have in modern life. And that kind of belief that we want to have that for someone to have killed as many people as Andrei Chikatilo goes on to, and you're going to find out it's loads, it's because they must have been in some way omnipotent, in some way superhumanly intelligent. They couldn't just have got away with it because of everything else we're about to tell you.
I couldn't agree more. Like, he gets away with it because Russia's fucking massive. The end.
Exactly.
So he was rejected from Moscow State University on political grounds, and that did happen. Basically, if they thought you were trouble, you weren't getting in. And Chikatilo was sure that this was because of his father, and it may well have been. But he never quite let it go. And I think another reason this like idea of him being super intellectual pervades is because it's what he told everyone. He really fancied himself an intellectual, but he decided that if he wasn't going to Moscow State, he wasn't going anywhere. And he decided to get a communications degree from a technical college instead and went on to be a telephone engineer. And being a telephone engineer was excellent work if you could get it. Russia industrialized totally in the space of 30 years, which is an astonishing feat. And that meant that there were lots of phone lines that needed installing. And the city of Rostov, or Rostov-on-Don, depending on which Google map you're looking at, is where Europe meets Asia. And it's also an industrial center nearest to Shakhty, which is where we will be focusing on a little bit later. But Rostov is bigger than Shakhty and it was starting to make an economic comeback. The actual work, the telephone engineering bit, Chikatilo had little problem with. Now he was in his 20s, he did have significant problems with his co-workers. Just like the kids at school, they thought he was weird. And this theory was confirmed one day when Chikatilo told his team that he was going for a wee, and he walked off the site into some woodland. He wasn't going for a wee.
Uh-oh. Was he going for a dirty wee?
He was going for a wank.
AKA
which, a dirty wee is what they're calling it. That's like what they're calling it in Soviet Russia. And this turns me inside out. Because he was so short-sighted.
No.
He didn't realise that the rest of his engineering team could see him.
Oh no.
As he was doing a wank in the woods.
Oh no.
Yeah, he was having a woody wank and everyone could see, which, awful. So they all saw, he died of embarrassment and they never ever let him forget it.
Oh dear.
But you wouldn't, would you? Like, no. Well, A, why are you wanking at work? And two, no. We can see you.
No, I mean, if I did see you at work, just disappear into a glass meeting room to have a dirty wee, I'd probably never let it go.
Can you imagine?
I mean, I'm trying not to, but
I'm just really stressed.
We've got a puppy room and a wanking room. Which one do you want? You can't mix the two. That's not allowed.
That's not allowed.
Never the two shall meet. So obviously, as you can imagine, after this woodwank situation, Chikatilo withdrew even further, constantly humiliated. He retracted into a recluse. And to make things worse, he was just 27 at this point, and he was unmarried. And if you think, that's not that bad. This is the 50s and the 60s in the USSR, baby, so he was basically over the fucking hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everyone had died in the war. It's not that many men, loads of women. And they're still like, weirdo woodwanker, I don't want to marry him.
In the 50s in the USSR, I think just any man who wasn't drunk all the time and wanting to beat you to death was probably like a catch. But it's not all doom and gloom. I mean, it kind of is. But let's have a little moment of romance, shall we? Because in 1963, Andrei Chikatilo finally caught a break. when he met Faina, and she was capable and confident in all the ways that Andre Ciccatillo was not. So they went out for a while, but never managed to have actual penetrative sex. Not for a lack of trying. And Faina put all of this down just to nerves and was sure that Andre Ciccatillo would be able to maintain an erection after they got married and after they were no longer living in sin. So they got married the same year they met. But the nuptials did not solve Ciccatillo's penis problem. That didn't stop them from having children, though. Two, in fact, which were conceived manually. And I know how they did this. And there wasn't a turkey baster. In the notes, it says, we'll leave you to figure it out. But I'm just going to say, just a wood wank and then a hand insertion.
Yeah, he's putting it in there with his hands.
Yeah. Which, like, I know, obviously, it makes sense that that could still work. But it is shocking that she got pregnant that way.
Twice.
That's unbelievable.
She must have been extremely fertile.
Extremely fertile. Which, again, like, for people who were basically starving.
Yeah.
Surrounded by just, like, nuclear power plants. How?
Summer is in full swing. And what better time to refresh your underwear drawer? You know we love and trust in Honeylove to keep us comfortable and supported even on the sweatiest sun-soaked days. Honeylove are an independent female-founded brand who just get what we're looking for, with products intelligently designed by women who actually wear them. I am absolutely obsessed with their Cloud Embrace bra. It's a wireless bra that still holds the girls up so I don't feel like I'm sacrificing support for comfort. And if you've still got some weddings this season, Honeylove are coming in clutch with the shapewear you need to cut up the dance floor. Treat yourself to the most advanced bras and shapewear on the market. Use our exclusive link to save 20% off Honeylove at honeylove.com/redhanded. That's honeylove.com/redhanded. After you check out, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience the new standard in comfort and support with Honeylove. Have you been sitting on an amazing business idea, but you're just not sure how to get started? Shopify can help you with everything you need to make it happen. Shopify powers millions of businesses worldwide, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to small businesses just getting started. The multifunctional platform includes tools like Shopify Checkout, which helps convert your customers' baskets into real sales. With cool features like saving checkout details for easy repeat sales, Shopify makes it a total breeze. When we first started selling merch for Red Handed, it was such a relief to actually see people buying it and coming back for more. And because Shopify handles the setup and checkout process, it gives you more time to focus on actually growing your business. With Shopify, nothing stands between your idea and a real business. So go make it one. Start your free trial at shopify.com/redhanded. That's shopify.com/redhanded.
So the first of their children was a daughter called Lyudmila. She was born in 67, and then she was followed by her brother Yuri in 1969. And in the early years of their lives, Ciccatillo doted on his children. He played with them constantly. Perhaps it was easier for him to exist in a child fantasy world. He didn't like the real one too much. And fantasy started to play a major role in Faina Ciccatillo's sex life too. She was so desperate to have any kind of sex life at all that she went along with whatever her husband wanted her to do. And the role play started out, as you might expect when it comes from the mind of a man who's been humiliated his whole life. Essentially, Ciccatillo plays this kind of Nietzschean Superman, this perfect being. But as time went on, Ciccatillo became more and more physically dominant over his wife. He was so insecure that it's easy to forget that physically he was overpowering.
And I think when you see pictures of Ciccatillo, a lot of those pictures are towards the end.
Yes.
When he's already, you know,
like wasting away.
Yeah, and in a cage, in the courtroom, etc. But like, that's not what he looks like at this point.
No, he looks like what he is, which is a big burly farmer.
Mm-hmm. So outside the Ciccatillo family bedroom, the world was changing. The great post-Stalinist Soviet thaw had begun. Khrushchev gave his famous speech in 1956, denouncing the abuses of Stalin and his cult of personality. And he had promised to bury the West.
It's called The Secret Speech. Go and look it up. It's fascinating. And I mean, it's not a secret what he said because we just told you. But he was basically like, whoa, Stalin, that was a bit mental. Let's
move on.
Let's move on, yeah.
The USSR were kind of smashing it at this point. Industry was rapidly spreading across the land, and Soviets were crushing the space race.
They really were. I think because the US were the first to put a man on the moon, everyone forgets that the first country to put an actual person in space were the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
It was like neck and neck.
And that's why, you know, we've talked about this a lot on Under the Duvet particularly, is why when Putin starts talking about the fall of Russia from being a superpower, from being a czarist empire that ruled such a fucking massive portion of the world, to then being a genuine superpower in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
to where they are now, which is if they didn't have oil and gas, they would essentially be pretty irrelevant, apart from being a massive fucking landmass. But a landmass, a lot of which is not particularly habitable. That's why he's so fucking angry about it all the time. Mm. And I think this serves as an interesting reminder to everybody exactly how far they have fallen. So Chikatilo, he fucking loved all this. He loved the space race, the growth, the like industrialization. He was fucking mad for it. And he was also a card-carrying member of the Communist Party for 25 years. And in the 70s, he finally got the academic degree that he'd always wanted. So things are kind of, you know, better. He's got a wife, he's got two kids.
Yeah. At this stage, it's kind of as good as it gets for him. He finally gets to be the academic that he always wanted to be. It starts going pretty steeply downhill in a minute. But I think what I really want, we'll come onto this a bit more next week. Spoilers, this is two parts. But when communism fell, Andrei Chikatilo took it extremely personally.
Yes, I would imagine so, because the start of things, in my opinion, not going very well, is that he studied Marx and Engels absolutely tirelessly, along with the Russian language and philology.
While he was studying at the University of Rostov, he had a job in a sports centre, and he told everyone he was studying for a doctorate. He wasn't. He had an undergraduate degree, but I think everyone assumes that he's some sort of mega genius just because he told them that he was.
Exactly. And I think, you know, none of this is like particularly shocking. This man is a fucking would-be, goes on to be serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
Of course he's a fucking narcissist. Of course he's a fucking megalomaniac.
And everyone at the sports centre did pick up on that. They all thought he was a bit weird, but there were no major incidents recorded while he worked there. The same cannot be said for his next job. He began to teach. That seemed like an obvious move. He was well-educated, relatively, and he liked young people. But he was absolutely terrible at it. He was a shockingly bad teacher.
Of course he was. Can you imagine a job that requires more confidence than being a teacher?
Nope.
Standing in front of a group of all the way down from children to university, like postgrads, the level of confidence you need to do that. And he is one of the most insecure men we've ever come across.
He had absolutely no classroom management skills, and the children he taught had so little respect for him that they smoked in front of him in the classroom. So once again, he lived a life of ridicule, and this time it's coming from children, which is even worse. He found his classroom experiences so emotionally bruising that he would often come close to fainting.
Right, now strap up, because this is where things start to go from bad to much, much worse. Because the adults at the school didn't like Chikatilo either. He was constantly whining. He never socialised and preferred instead to read his beloved communism books. And it didn't help that he walked around with his hands in his pockets. Not in a kind of, I'm cool, blasé kind of
way.
How
do you do, fellow kids?
Yeah.
Definitely not that.
No. In a much more of an I'm obviously fondling myself kind of way. Everyone knew. But they just ignored it. He was a good communist, after all.
That saves his butt so many times.
That's the thing. I feel like if you were a good communist at the time, they'd just be like, well, we'll just let that slide too.
It's like
last week. Yeah, you're a good singer. Well, the week before, you're a good singer, so we'll just let all this slide. That's a banger. But things with Chikatilo got quite difficult to ignore when in May 1973, he took his class on a trip to a river. And when the children were swimming, he pursued one of the girls. She was just 15 and described in all the books about this case as being one of the more quote unquote developed in the class. I think we can all guess what that means. So This girl tries to get away from Chikatilo, but he quickly caught up with her and grabbed her under the water. For the next few moments, his hands clawed at the girl's breasts and hips. As she struggled, his body stiffened in climax, and then he let her go.
And there was another incident at the same school. He had a female student in his classroom and he locked the door. He attempted to grab her and she jumped out the window.
Oh my God.
So even Soviet parents, even communism-loving parents, they're like, oh, he's a party man. Even they couldn't stand for it. And so it was made abundantly clear to Andrei Chikatilo that he needed to leave the school quietly to avoid a scene. He dutifully did this, but apparently no one thought to pass on the molester message to any other schools in the region. And he quickly got another job at a boys' school, which has the most Soviet name in the world, Technical School 33.
Oh my God.
Yes, and it was about 40 miles outside of Rostov, which is the city where Chikatilo had done his degree. The boys in this establishment were being trained as mining industry technicians, and they were usually between 15 and 19 years old. And Chikatilo wasn't really teaching at this institute. He was more like a den mother. He was looking after the part of the school that the boys slept in.
Yeah.
Worst place for him, really.
This is definitely a theme that we'll come back to, I know, over the course of the next two episodes. Oh, did we say this is a two-parter? It's a two-parter. But the idea was that definitely at this point in the Soviet Union, obviously it was like, fuck the West. We hate the West. All of the problems in the world are because of like Western capitalism, etc. So the idea that somebody was a child molester, at that point, the Soviet Union also saw that as like being a Western thing that couldn't possibly be happening here. So I think also the reason they didn't tell other schools was because then they'd have to admit that this had happened and they'd rather just be like, it's fine. It didn't really happen. Just leave. So I'm sure you can imagine where we are going when we talk about, with concern, the idea that Chikatilo was a den mother looking after the boys as they slept at this school. By 1978, Andrei Chikatilo was spending less and less time with his own children and making frequent visits to the technical school boys' dormitory in the middle of the night. When he was there, he'd expose himself and molest the boys in their sleep. And unbelievably, yet again, he got away with this for quite a few years, for multiple reasons. Initially, the rest of the faculty turned a blind eye, as, again, he was such a devout party member, but also because Chikatilo had a quality that doesn't quite translate into English. Blat.
Yeah, so many things in Russian just don't, they just don't translate at all.
Yeah, and I think, like, we also have to understand, and again, this is why when I tried to understand like the war in Russia and things like that, I tried to watch actual people who understand Russia and who are Russian talking about it, because they are the only ones that can explain to us like the psychology of Russia or the Russian people or whatever it might be. I think I was even watching something where they were like, was it Ivan the Terrible? And how Ivan the Terrible isn't called Ivan the Terrible. He's called like Ivan the Wise, because it's, again, it's like a completely different mentality and a different way of looking at things. And even thousands of people dying in a war, which may seem odd somewhere else for the reasons that are being proclaimed, may not seem that weird there because of the value system or whatever it might be. And I think it's fair to say, like, it is just a much more like brutal sensibility. And I think that coming back to blat, though, essentially what blat is a combination of influence and connections that you either have or you don't. Essentially, it was the idea that Chikatilo was a jammy bastard.
Yeah, it's not like someone with the gift of gab who's like charming. It's someone who doesn't have to try and everything just works out.
Interesting. And again, I think it is probably also, yeah, he's a party member, but also because they're like, we shouldn't really be talking about the fact that this is happening, because don't we constantly get told that these kind of perversions don't happen in this country because everything's fine?
Well, I don't know. That's quite often the like rhetoric that's attached to this story. I don't know if I buy it. To be honest, I think people just had bigger things to worry about, like how they were going to feed their children. And we'll come on to a bit later why I think, and everyone is very welcome to disagree with me, that I do think the authorities knew for a long time, because the authorities were the only ones who knew anything, because everything was so censored. Like, no one had any information.
There's actually a movie that I think is loosely based on Chikatilo's life.
Child 33.
Yeah. And it's like a killer, serial killer. Yeah. Uses the trains or something.
Yes, it is. Very loosely. Or might be Child 44 or something. Child number.
Yeah.
Yes, it is based on Chikatilo. Ah. But in so much as that there are some people in a gulag and there are trains and children go missing. It's based on a series of books.
Yes, it is. I only remember, like, I didn't actually know if it definitely was, and I was going to just cut this out if I was wrong and I checked afterwards. But I remember watching that film and thinking, this is Chikatilo. But yeah, it's worth a watch. It's worth a watch.
While Chikatilo was working at the boys' technical school, he spent more time between Rostov and Shakhty, which is where he was seen doodling miniature crosses. Quite a lot of this story happens in Rostov and Shakhty and in between.
I mean, his nickname was the Rostov Ripper.
Yes. Actually, he spent so much time in Shakhty that he bought, under a false name and without his wife's knowledge, what can only be described as a hovel. It was 26 Mexavoy Lane. It's a shed. It's a shed. It's not a house. Don't listen to anyone who says it's a house. And he would lure children and young people to his shack and molest them. Shakhty is about 2 hours from Rostov on the train, and it's now in modern-day Ukraine. The word Shakhty quite literally means mines, and the coal pits stretch all the way to the Donbass region. The Shakhty mines are some of the most dangerous in the world. Hardly any of the miners live to see their pensions. The accident rate is so high that for every 1 million tons of coal the mines produce, someone loses their life. And it was in Shakhty that Andre Chikatilo took his first life, or at least the first one that we know about.
Her name was Lenkocha Zakatinova, sometimes called Yelena, and she was just 9 years old. Yelena was last seen wearing a red coat with a fur hood on her way home from ice skating. The day before she went missing, she told her friend about a man who gave her chewing gum, a rare delicacy in the USSR. She was spotted at a tram stop, meeting her gum friend, a tall man wearing a long, dark coat. Chikatilo, the gum dealer, took little Yelena to his little dugout shack, and as soon as he got her inside, he crushed her with his weight, and he had every intention of raping the small girl, but he discovered that he couldn't. And I don't mean that like he couldn't because he was sad.
No.
He physically couldn't.
His body wouldn't let him. Yeah.
Yes. And so this physical situation infuriated him, so much so that he stabbed the girl, orgasming as he did so. For the first time in his life, Andre Chikatilo had been freed of his impotence. This is the classic thing. He's like, so many serial killers, they don't just automatically know a lot of them exactly what's going to do it for them. They experiment, and sometimes they discover what turns them on by accident, which is obviously what's happened here. I think John Wayne Gacy was very similar, that he like had a boy at his house, and then in the morning the boy was like making him breakfast, and he thought the boy was trying to stab him because he was holding a knife, so he killed him. And when he did, he came and he was like, oh yeah, that's it.
Peter Curtin as well.
Sheepshagger.
Yep.
So after he had done this, after he'd stabbed the girl and he'd come, he didn't stop. Instead, he strangled the small girl, and before he knew it, she was dead. So now he had a body to get rid of, so he quickly collected himself and the girl's bloody clothes and her school backpack. He disposed of her body in a nearby river with the hopes that she would be taken far, far downstream where no one would recognise her.
That didn't happen.
Yeah, I feel like that is a bold expectation. It's not the fucking sea. She's just going to get stuck on some branches or something.
Exactly, that's exactly what happened. Yelena was found in her red coat with the fur hood on the 24th of December, washed up on the river's bank. And Chikatilo was immediately under suspicion because, as he left his little shack to dispose of her body, he forgot to turn the light off. And this was unusual because he didn't live there. All of his neighbours noticed that the light had been left on for days. But his blat helped him out once again. He escaped the long arm of the law, and instead, local 25-year-old Alexander Kravchenko paid the ultimate price for the little girl's death. Kravchenko had been known to the police for some time. He'd been convicted of a similar rape and murder years before, but because he was a minor when he did it, he escaped the death penalty. After he got out of prison, he was living in Shakhty, keeping a low profile. But for the police, it seemed like an obvious connection he had formed. He was in the area. Even though his wife gave him a solid gold alibi, none of it mattered. Kravchenko was tortured by police and he eventually confessed. The only physical evidence, and I mean the only physical evidence that the police had, were nettle fibres found on his trousers that were similar to, not the same, similar to the nettles on the riverbank where Yelena's body was found on Christmas Eve. But the tenuousness of that doesn't matter. And in March 1983, Kravchenko was executed by firing squad. He was pardoned years later, but that doesn't really make a difference when you're already dead. No one had paid attention to the blood smeared on the snow outside Chikatilo's hut.
So Chikatilo had got away with it, his very first murder. He was relieved, but he was also afraid. He knew for a fact that if he ever found himself in the same position, he knew he would kill again. He was reviled with himself, but he knew that that wouldn't last. Neither would his jamminess at work, because in 1981, he was finally asked to leave the boys' technical school. And once again, he left quietly, without making a fuss. In fact, he left teaching behind altogether and took a job as a supply clerk for an industrial company. And that meant that he was going to be travelling a lot, which of course worked out very well for him. It meant that his wife had no reason to ask him where he was, and it meant that he could spend a lot of his time in train stations.
His next victim was 17-year-old Larissa Tuchenko. She was Moldovan. And she, in all of the books that are very outdated, she's described as this sort of like bad student, but like slept with soldiers and like smoked and drank and whatever. And you're like, whatever. She's a stereotype is how she's portrayed. But obviously she's much more than that. She was a human person. So one afternoon in early September 1981, Larissa was on her way to go and work at a collective farm with the rest of her friends from school. But she never made it. On her way, she bumped into Chikatilo. And he told her that they could go to a relaxation station along the river, which is like cafes, bars. A lot of bars like to play the Beatles, which you would think seems super capitalist, but they did have that song back in the USSR. They were big fans of communism. So the Beatles were allowed. It's the Soviet idea of tourism. I have a picture in my head of just like grey buildings, grey rubber rings, grey water.
Just grey and sad.
Chikatilo told Larissa that they would be able to lie down together unnoticed at this relaxation station. And she willingly went with him. As soon as they left the main road, Chikatilo realised two things. Number one, this young woman was willing to have sex with him. And number two, he was not going to be able to get it up. As soon as they were out of sight, he pushed Larissa to the ground. He had struggled with his conscience for the past 2.5 years, but now all of that was up in smoke. He punched Larissa in the head and strangled her until she went limp. And as she lay there dying, he bit her nipple off. Once Larissa was dead, Chikatilo ran around her body screaming like a bird child. He threw her clothes up into the branches of the trees. Later, he admitted that he felt like a partisan. He was righting all of the wrongs that had been rained down upon him during his life. That's exactly what Peter Curtin said. It's exactly what Karl Panzram said. It's such a classic rhetoric of the, like, uber serial killer that's like, well, I have been so hard done by and I have been so damaged that it's only fair that I reap my revenge.
These behaviours that we see in serial killers, you know, it's what draws us obviously to true crime, as all of us listening, Hannah and I, it's the kind of extremes of human behaviour. But it's interesting because obviously a lot of these behaviours exist on a spectrum in humanity. And it's like, we all know lots and lots of people who feel very hard done by life. And you're like, why are you so angry? He is just an extreme version of that.
Absolutely.
He also, because of his insecurity, I think definitely because of his erectile dysfunction, all of these things coupled together and his, you know, being rejected from university, all of those things, he felt incredibly angry and powerless. And this is just his way of taking back that power.
Exactly. And he enjoyed the ecstasy of taking back that power after Larissa died for about half an hour. And then he realised that once again, he had a body to dispose of. This time, he didn't bother to move the body. He just covered it with some branches and rolled Larissa's clothes up into a ball. This murder felt different to the first one. He didn't feel guilty at all. Actually, he felt like Larissa had brought it on herself. And he uses that idea, which we are still incredibly guilty of like, oh, well, what was she doing walking off with a strange man? It's slightly different, and we'll go on to talk about this later. In the Soviet Union, it wasn't really like that. And I think that's the key thing of like the completely censored press of like no bad news. People genuinely thought that bad things didn't happen. And Larissa was found the next day.
And Chikatilo would never be the same again. Until this point, one could argue that his kills were not premeditated. But certainly, we won't be able to say that after what happened next. Because he went on what can only be described as a rampage. 1 year after he killed Larissa, he spotted 13-year-old Liuba Buruk, and he abducted her as she walked to buy some food for her mother. Again, Chikatilo attempted to rape her, but he couldn't. So in a fit of rage, he stabbed her repeatedly. He then covered her body with her clothes and left her in the woods. A pile of her bones were found 2 weeks later, and although Liuba was Chikatilo's third victim, she would be the first one that the police connected to the series of murders in later years.
Yeah, once the police figure out that they've got a serial killer on their hands, they only connect some of them to him, and it's not until he confesses, essentially, that they can piece all of the other ones together.
Which again just tells you, I know he was moving around because of being able to travel and things like that, but it again tells you like what kind of a state the country was in at that time, that just like all these bodies turning up around the same time, they were just like, we don't even know which one's the serial killer or which one's just like random.
Oh,
murders.
Totally, because the murder rate was incredibly high, especially in Rostov. And I apologise, but the next bit is pretty relentless. Obviously, he's a big hitter. He killed a lot of people, and he also killed them all in extremely similar ways. So here we go. Strap in. On the 7th of August, the decomposed body of Lyubov Volobyeva, just 14, was discovered in an orchard near Krasnodar Airport, which is 4.5 hours drive south of Rostov. She had been lying there for over a month before she was discovered, and she would not be connected to Chikatilo for decades. And neither would his next and first male victim.
He was 9-year-old Oleg Posyhideyev, and he was reported missing on the 13th of August 1982. Oleg was never found.
16-year-old Olga Kuprinya was discovered decomposing in a field naked in October by a soldier gathering wood. She had run away from school and just vanished.
Irina Karabelennikova was found disfigured on the 16th of August. She was homeless, and she'd been lured away from Shakti train station by Chikatilo.
Another runaway, 15-year-old Sergei Kuzmin's body was discovered in the woods close to Shakti station. Chikatilo murdered him on the 15th of September 1982, just a week after he killed Irina. Sergei's remains were not discovered for a further 4 months.
Olya Stalmanchenko, 10 years old, was missing for 4 months before finally being found under an electric pylon.
Runaway Laura Sarkisian's mutilated corpse was found by the train tracks in June 1983. She too had been murdered in the woodland near Shakti station.
13-year-old Irina Duninkova was found stabbed to death in the woods on the Rostov Road. Chikatilo had known her for years, and Irina also had Down syndrome.
24-year-old Lyudmila, which is his daughter's name, by the way, Kutsyuba, was a mother of two. She was found stabbed to death in the July of 83, again near Shakti bus station, and yet again in the woodland.
7-year-old Igor Gudkov was found dead in Aviators Park, just outside Rostov Airport, on the 9th of August 1983. 7-year-old Igor was Chikatilo's youngest victim of all, and he was also the first male victim to be linked to the subsequent manhunt.
The next month, an unidentifiable woman was found in the shelter belt, which is like the woods on the side of a train track, between Shakti and Rostov. All we know about her is that she was between 18 and 24 and she had the blood type B.
Chikatilo claimed that she was a sex worker who was looking for a client with a car. Then, sometime after, on the 19th of September 1983, Valentina Kuchelina was killed in a wooded area near Kapichineia station. Kapichineia is about halfway between Rostov and Krasnodar.
Basically, all of these murders, and we're not done, I'm afraid, there are more, they all happen in essentially a straight line along this one train track.
Yeah, I was going to say, like in the way a train runs.
Yeah, it is a lot of ground to cover. It's many, many hundreds of miles. Sorry, chaps, we are going to have to keep going. In October of the same year, 19-year-old Vera Shevkin was found dead in a village near Shakti.
In December, Sergei Markov was discovered dead with 70 stab wounds. He had been on his way home from work experience and was just 14 years old.
On the 10th of January 1984, Natalia Shalapinia was found dead in Aviators Park. She had been a friend of previous victim Oya. She had actually been the one to put her on the bus the day she was abducted.
On the 22nd of February 1984, the body of Marta Rybenko was found in the same park. Her nipples and her uterus had been removed. She was 44 years old.
I believe Aviators Park has now been rebranded as the Botanical Gardens. But why one would go to a botanical garden next to an airport is beyond me, I'm afraid.
Killing some time before your next flight. Yeah. Why not?
Go and look at the Venus flytrap.
Exactly. Go on a little horrible history walking tour of the Rostov Rippers killing ground.
Yeah, I'm not surprised they changed the name.
No, me either. And also, this is why you see him. I know he has other names. He's also called like the Red Ripper, I believe, and also the Butcher of Rostov. But you can see why the word Ripper creeps in, because the tearing out of uteruses was, of course, the OG Jack the Ripper's favourite ever thing to do. So that horrible list of things that we just told you takes us up to 23 murders in the space of 8 years. How had this gone unnoticed, you might be thinking? Well, like Hannah said earlier, the murder rate in Rostov was extremely high. To give you an idea, in the first 5 months of 1992, there were 8,364 premeditated murders committed in Russia, and Rostov, as an industrial centre, was vastly above average. Authorities couldn't deny the similarities between all of the murders that we just told you about. All of them were found between Shakhty, Rostov and Krasnodar, usually, like we said, near the train line. Other similarities were, again, that they were all kind of in a straight line, and all of the victims had been stabbed, often in and around their eyes. Many of them also had missing organs, and all of them had no witnesses and absolutely no evidence.
So it was pretty impossible to ignore, and that meant that Lieutenant Viktor Barokov headed up a task force to try and find the killer. This was called Operation Shelter Belt. And so far, they had connected at least 10 murders between Rostov and Krasnodar that they thought had been carried out by the same person. And we already know that they were more than right. The victim selection and spread out nature of Chikatilo's MO is perhaps more understandably bamboozling to the authorities. That's why serial killers who don't care who they kill are so difficult to track down.
But you really have to ask what Andrei Chikatilo's wife thought he was doing all this time. Faina knew that her husband had no interest in her. He never had, not sexually anyway. She had, of course, heard rumours that he was molesting children. But because she had never seen him maintain an erection, she was convinced that he had no sexual interest in anything at all. On top of this, his job did mean that he had to travel a lot, like we said earlier. And she never felt like she could really question it. He was the breadwinner, and she did what she was told. Even when her husband returned home from his business trips covered in scratches, he just told her they had been helping load equipment into trucks, and Faina chose to believe him.
That's the key thing. She chooses to believe. She's not picking holes in any stories. Chikatilo may have been pulling the wool over Faina's eyes, but the police seemed to be totally blind. In March 1984, there was yet another murder, and it really should have been enough to at least compile a suspect list. Dmitry Tishinnikov was just 10 years old. He was not a runaway. He wasn't homeless or a sex worker. He was very much the opposite of the less dead. He was gifted and from a prosperous family. He was an enthusiastic stamp collector, and he was tempted away from a stamp kiosk by Chikatilo, who was pretending to be a philatelist. And we know this to be true because Chikatilo was spotted doing just that.
One of Dmitry's neighbours had watched the boy walk off with a 5'10" to 6' man, wearing glasses and carrying a briefcase. This man had one defining feature, a pronounced limp. And during that time, Chikatilo had a blood vessel problem in his left leg, which caused him to drag it slightly as he walked. Dmitry's body was found with 54 stab wounds, and near the site of his undignified burial, police also discovered a footprint. It was big, clearly that of a man with size 43 to 44 feet.
Which doesn't seem like much, but considering there is literally no other forensic evidence at all, it's kind of a jackpot.
Mm-hmm. So this is the first time they have sort of physical evidence as well as a witness.
Yes.
So they're like, okay, this is it.
But even still, the police didn't get any closer to Chikatilo, and he went on to kill again. During the summer of 1984, Chikatilo was killing more than one person a week, and he was also becoming a lot more confident. He started to go after people he knew. Chikatilo and 29-year-old Tanya Petrosyan had known each other for a few years, and they had actually been lovers. They first met in 1978, when Tanya had been working at the Shakti Station shop. Chikatilo was 20 years older than her, but she liked him. Admittedly, being screamed at all day by angry men late for their trains did mean that she had rather low standards. Their affair didn't last long, probably because of his erectile dysfunction. Tanya never even knew his last name. All she knew was that he was married and that he was a teacher. And they reunited in the summer of 1984. Tanya was recently divorced and she agreed to a picnic in the woods with her old flame. And she also, to Chikatilo's delight, brought along her 10-year-old daughter Svetlana.
The trio walked into the familiar Shakti woods and the adults soon got down to business. But, as usual, Chikatilo was not in full command of his body. As soon as Tanya realised that Chikatilo still couldn't get it up all of these years later, she jeered at him, saying, "Call yourself a man." And just as it had all of those times before, this mocking enraged him. He wasted no time in stabbing her in the side of the head, and then he pounded Tanya to death with a hammer. It was over quickly, but then Chikatilo realised that for the first time ever, he had killed someone in front of a witness.
Little Svetlana started to run as soon as she heard her mother's first scream, but her 10-year-old legs were no match for the still hulking Chikatilo. He's nearly 50 at this point, but he's still big. He caught her and killed her just like he had her mother, and he left both bodies in the woods. Tanya's mother reported the two missing a few days later. They weren't found until July. Svetlana's head had been totally severed from her body and was discovered 5 foot from the rest of her.
Chikatilo never killed in front of a witness again, but he sure as shit kept killing. Yelena Bakalina was next. She was 22, and her body was discovered in Rostov covered in branches. Then Dmitry Yelarinov, who was just 13, vanished in Rostov on his way to collect a health certificate on the 10th of July. Just 9 days later, so again you're seeing that kind of cooling off period between the kills getting shorter and shorter, because on the 19th of July, Anna Lemensheva disappeared on her way back from the dentist, killed near Kapichana station. Anna was just 19. Then 20-year-old Sarmite Tanza, she was just 20, and she was killed in July and found in Aviators Park months later. And Sarmite was originally from Riga.
On the 2nd of August 1984, Chikatilo met 16-year-old Natasha Golosovska, again near a bus stop, near Rostov Airport. She was not his usual victim type. She was visiting her sister, so she would be missed. But he still managed to lead her away from the bus stop, promising her a shortcut and a faster bus. She was from the country and she didn't know any better. Chikatilo took her deep into the forest, where he stabbed her to death, and then left. Natasha was found by a park keeper the next day, but Chikatilo was long gone by then. He did exactly the same thing to 17-year-old Luida Alexeyeva. She didn't know the city either, so he led her into the forest. He prolonged her suffering as long as humanly possible, and she was found 3 days later.
He didn't keep his killing inside the Russian border either. If Chikatilo's work took him to Uzbekistan, then he took his bloodlust with him. As soon as he landed in Tashkent, the first thing he did was buy a knife. He killed two women between the 8th and the 15th of August. The first was found without her head and was never identified.
The second victim was Akmaral Saylieva. She was 10 years old. She'd run away from Kazakhstan. Naturally, these Uzbek murders would not be connected to Chikatilo for years.
As soon as he was back in Russia, Chikatilo picked up 11-year-old Sasha Chepel at a bus stop. His body was later discovered on the banks of the River Don. His corpse was so mangled that Sasha's father actually fainted when he saw it. Up until this point, for obvious Stalin-shaped reasons, not a single one of the murders carried out by Chikatilo, or anyone else for that matter, were being reported in the press. Like we said earlier, there was no bad news in the USSR, only extremely productive people living the communist dream. But Sasha's murder was different. The story started to spread on its own. There were even rumours that he had been swept away in a black limo that had the registration SSO, which was recognised widely at the time for meaning death to Soviet children. So Sasha's murder found its way into the local communist daily newspaper called Molot, was not connected to any other murders at this point, but still it was in the press, and that was a start.
We've got one last murder for you. I wish I could say it was the last for Chikatilo, but it isn't. On the 6th of September 1984, 24-year-old Irina Luchinskaya was on her way to a steam bath with her friends. She was a librarian by day and steam enjoyer by night. She told her mother that she would be home late, but she would not be home at all. She was intercepted by Chikatilo at a bus stop and walked with him to the nearby woods. As usual, he couldn't get an erection. She called him pathetic, so he killed her. He punched her and stabbed her to death, and then, being too far from home to return without being questioned, he slept in his office that night.
By September 1984, Berikov had his top man, Inspector Alexander Zanasovsky, on the case, and he had been staking out Rostov for some time. He was also sure that the Soviet Union had a serial killer on their hands, and he was going to be the one to bring this guy down. But on the 13th of September, he spotted a furtive man moving through the crowds carrying a briefcase.
Inspector Alexander Zanasovsky followed this man for over 9 hours as he moved from woman to woman, obviously chatting them up. Sometimes he would speak to as many as 12 women in an hour. Zanasovsky had seen this man before, doing the same thing in the same place. He had a feeling that this was the man he was looking for. Finally, the man he was watching managed to get a woman to stick around. She lay down with her head on his lap on a park bench and he covered her head with his jacket. I don't need to explain what's happening under there. You can figure it out on your own. And after that, they parted ways. And Zanasovsky easily cornered the man, who he described as the sweatiest person he had ever seen. He said it was rolling off him. And Zanasovsky demanded to see the man's papers. And the man's name was, but of course, Andrei Romanovich Chikatilo. He was 48 years old. And inside his briefcase, he had a kitchen knife. It was bent like it had been used to hack something hard, like bone. He also had 8 inches of rope and a tube of Vaseline in his briefcase. And Chikatilo matched the descriptions the police had been given. He also had the correct shoe size. So naturally, he was arrested.
It was also easy for Zanasovsky to find out that not only was Chikatilo a member of the Communist Party, but that he had also been a child molester, and that he had stolen from his place of work, which in Soviet language means he had stolen from the state. So although the Soviet language was changing, there was vast political change in 1983 and 1984. Brezhnev had died, and he was replaced by former KGB chief Yuri Andropov. The Soviet economy had appeared to be on the brink of death for some time, but Andropov thought that he was the man to save it. The common saying amongst workers at the time was, quote, "We pretend to work and they pretend to pay us." Andropov wanted to obliterate this rhetoric and brought in harsh punishments and strict discipline for the workforce. Unsurprisingly, turning the USSR into a giant gulag didn't work. And because Chikatilo was more of a solo operation, he remained his own master through most of the new rules. But eventually, he was in trouble and lost his job over some stolen lino.
The story of Chikatilo and how he managed to kill so many people is often chalked up to the higher-ups in the Soviet Union not believing that serial killers could exist in socialist paradise, that serial killing was a Western disease like corruption and unemployment. But I just don't think that's true.
I think you're right in that it's not that the higher-ups didn't realise that this could be true. It's like they don't want the proles to know that this can be true. They're like, only good news. None of that happens here. We know it happens here. You don't know it happens here.
Exactly. And that's what Soviet TV propagated, that crime only happened in the West. And that meant that there was a carefree attitude among the population. And I think that's the thing that people don't realise, is that if you're living in a world where you really don't think anything bad happens, then it's easier to walk down the street with a man you don't know. And also, I thought this was very interesting. People in the Soviet Union were much more likely to stop and speak to someone that they'd never met before than maybe we are in the West, certainly in London. Because number one, they were queuing all the time. There are, Russian correspondent told me there's like a very old Soviet joke that where everyone's standing in line and someone says to the other one, they're like, oh, what are we waiting for? And they're like, I don't know, but the line's huge, so it must be good.
Yeah, no, I can absolutely see that. And I also think, just to come back to the idea of, like, they're constantly obviously being told by state propaganda that nothing bad happens. It's a great place to live. Everything is A-OK. Like, we're in communism. But obviously people would have known that bad things, or people would have talked about bad things happening amongst themselves. But it's that mindset, isn't it, of like how much faith and belief they had in the state and how powerful the state was. That, like, today, even with all the evidence of what's going on in Ukraine, so many people in Russia are still like, well, no, our government's telling us that that's not what's happening. And I believe them.
And it's that culture that Chikatilo took full advantage of. The higher ups in local police knew for a fact that murders happened. The murder rates were sky high. But they were the only ones that knew that, because everything else was heavily censored. So yes, I think individually people would obviously have known that bad things happen because people are discovering these bodies. What they wouldn't have been able to do is connect them, because nothing was being reported. So the police definitely knew, and the higher-ups in Moscow certainly knew that they had a serial killer on the loose, and that was bad Soviet Union PR. So that meant the pressure was on. Moscow needed a solution to this problem ASAP before any more of it made it into the heavily regulated press. And that was Zanazovsky's job. He'd been sitting on a hunch for quite some time, and if he was right, then there were innocent men in prison, and another was dead. But on that September day in 1984, Zanazovsky let Andrei Chikatilo walk free to kill again. And he would not catch up with Chikatilo again until the mid-90s. But to find out what happens, to find out where he goes next, to find out if he actually does get caught, you're going to have to come back next week, because we can't possibly go on. I'll die.
No, that was a lot. It's a big case, but if we're going to do it, we have to do it right, you know? And I think, just to end on this, I think all the time when you think about Andrei Chikatilo case, because you see kind of those black and white pasto pictures of him, you think it's a really pasto case.
Mm-mm.
It's not. This all happened in the 50s and the 60s. It actually really hit home for me when you said that one of his children was born in 1969. That's the year my mum was born.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like 53.
Yeah.
It's not that long ago.
The next time he's arrested, you and I were both alive.
Yeah. So keep that in mind. And we will see you next week. So if you would like to hear some more content from us, you can head on over, of course, as ever, to patreon.com/redhanded. Sign up at any tier you like and get a bunch of extra content, because you deserve it. And we don't really have anything else to say this week. So we'll see you next time.
Well, we will have stuff to say.
Yes.
For sure.
Very importantly. Bye.
Bye.